At some point, we will actually have a theme song, but in the meantime, hello!
Hello!
Welcome to Leeds Book Club podcast, the third. And we're recording this on an absolutely gorgeous day. And we really should be outside playing in the sun. This is how much we love both you and our books. I'm Leeds Book Club, and this is Book Elf Leeds.
Hello!
And today we're going to be talking about the varied wonders that are the works of Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters.
Yes, and we chose these two because they're fairly comparable, and also most people, I think, would say they're instrumental in bringing quite a lot of people to reading for the first time, especially to the classics.
Definitely.
And also the Bronte sisters are from Yorkshire, so you've got to give them a bit of a shout out for me. And Jane Austen just kind of changed the face of who I was as a person. So I think they're both fairly good things to talk about.
Definitely.
We're going to start off with the Bronte sisters. I should admit that I've got avid readers, Dr. Neville's massive chunk of a book that is her Bronte sisters complete novels illustrated collection.
It's less of a book and more of a bat if anybody ever breaks into the house.
Yeah.
But my favourite thing about it is that on the back page it just has the words, "Reader, I married him."
I married him.
Possibly the most romantic four words that exist ever since I've read Jane Eyre. Oh, and we also have to say that the BBC are instrumental in this as well, because they do really good adaptations of
these. They're very easy books to translate into film because they're beautiful stories. You can't really say that it's TV's fault. They've jumped on a bandwagon because
I just mean they've done them so beautifully.
I think that they're classics, and I think it's important that people watch the TV shows and compare the TV shows. And I think quite a lot of the time people I was introduced to, not to Jane Eyre, I read that first, but to Jane Austen. I was introduced to Jane Austen through
Emma Thompson.
Through Colin Farrell. Colin Firth.
Of course.
More than anything else. But anyway, Bronte sisters first. So, I've just reread Tenant of Wildfell Hall, which is by Anne Bronte. Now, Anne Bronte is the youngest of the sisters, and she was buried in Scarborough, where I'm from. And Anne Bronte's grave in Scarborough is a little bit of a
shrine.
It's in St Mary's Church, which is just gorgeous on the cliff. If you're ever in Scarborough, I recommend just popping up to St Mary's and having a look, because the view itself is worth it. Now, The Tent is quite an interesting book in that Anne Bronte lived with her brother Branwell for quite a while, and Branwell Bronte is known for being an alcoholic, and he had trouble with his addiction for years and years.
He generally went through being a bit of a shit stage.
Yeah, he took it out on his sisters, and it broke the family apart, and it really there's lots of theories as to how Branwell was affected by this, and how his sister's fame, even though his sisters had to pretend to be men in order to get that fame, but we're not going to go into that because I'll get cross.
No. George Eliot.
but The Tenant of Wildfell Hall is about this woman.
Quite an amazing woman, actually.
Yeah, Helen. Well, Helen Graham, she is known at the beginning of the book, and then.
Yeah.
But Helen, who lives as a tenant in this Wildfell Hall, which is this big house in the middle of this countryside, and the first half is very evocative of the countryside of the time. Mm. It's a farming community. It's a very, very small community, and the local gentleman farmer, this bloke in his 20s, whose name I cannot remember now.
Totally gone from me as well. I knew it until you said you couldn't remember.
Find the name. This guy falls in love with her, and she lives there with her young as a widow, and it's considered throughout the parish that she might be a bit loose.
Gilbert,
thank you. She might be a bit loose because there's lots of rumours about her and the local hall owner, Miss Lawrence.
She's really secretive. That's the basic problem. And she also, if she told anybody what was going on, they'd have been fine with her. But because she's so secretive, they all assume that there must be dark stories.
It's country rumours ruining a reputation.
And it's really well done. Coming from a small village, because there's no bitterness, is there? They're just nosy.
No, they're just nosy.
And in the absence of information, we'll make something up. But there's no malice to it. No. It's just the way that's how small towns work.
But Gilbert sets out to find the truth about this, and he confronts Helen, and he says, "Look, I love you." And it's that bit really well done as well. It's basically, "Look, I love you. I think this. This has made me think this."
But what happens next is what makes the book.
Yeah,
because she basically goes, "Well, that's very nice, dear. But I not really that interested in you, and you've made me feel so uncomfortable, I'm doing a disappearing act.
Well, she gives him her diary to read, and her diary is her life, basically, from when she was a teenage girl. And it turns out that she came from quite a well-off family, and her uncle and aunt, who she lived with, her father didn't want anything to do with her. Her father was also had troubles. He was a drinker, he was a drunk. So she lives with her aunt and uncle, who come across as quite sympathetic people who want the best for her. Mm. And they take her to London, where she meets Mr. Huntingdon, who is a shit.
And the thing is that she's writing about him as a woman who's in love for the first time. And even her writing makes him sound... It's like some part of her subconsciously recognised that he was a thorough shit.
Basically, she falls in love with him because he's a pretty boy and he's a charmer. And she's 18 and stupid. And we've all been there.
Mm. And although it's never explicitly stated, there's an element whereby he's interested in, you know, cracking the virgin nut.
Yeah.
It's never explicitly
but yeah, so he seduces her and eventually they marry. And there's also these other couples in their group. Again, it's very insular. There's only very few characters, but that's what it would be like. You'd only know, you know, 10 or 15
but
people.
But none of them
intimately.
Are islands either. They're all, you know, their lives interact with one another. What each of them does. I mean, there's one character throughout her story, her diary, can't think of his name. I'm so bad with names. But you know the guy that comes across as being quite nice.
And the neighbour guy.
The neighbour, and he's really into Helen, and he seems to want to do everything from the best of motivations. Mm. And when you can see that it's going to happen, but when it actually turns, and he turns out to be just as manipulative and mean, and to have just as puerile an interest in her, you do feel a little bit gutted, because it's like her last ally is gone, even though he wasn't much of an ally to begin with.
So she marries Huntingdon, and he treats her appallingly, and he obviously goes out to London to basically he's a bit of a lad. He likes his men to sit there and drink heavily and talk about girls,
and his women bent over a bush.
If you've ever been to Leeds and you've been on the Otley Run and the skyrack at about 6:30 on a Saturday, that sort of mentality, if you look at the group, the massive groups of men, rah! And no, just awful, awful. And Helen is very much, she's a gentle soul. She likes a painting. She's a painter. She, you know, she plays the piano, and she doesn't, they're just ill matched. And I think the point of the book is that it shows that they're so desperate to marry people off, and there's no outlet for just learning about each other and living together for a bit. And you know, you can't just sleep with somebody in these books. If you do, it's like, but you know, there's no outlet for her to explore her sexuality with Huntingdon, which would probably work for her. If she was in nowadays, they'd have probably
tried,
and then she'd have gone, actually, you're a twat. And
no, what I find interesting is if you compare sort of the parental roles there, is that in so, because we're going to be talking about Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen, so we might as well drag it up now. Jane and Elizabeth and Mary and Kitty and Lizzie's mother, especially I think on film, comes across as real shrill. I thought the best version of the mother that I've seen was Brenda Blethyn in the 2005 movie, because for the first time watching Pride and Prejudice, you got the sense that she's just terrified that her husband's going to die and she's going to be stuck with 5 daughters and no means to support them.
Which is a real fear.
But she is willing to marry them off to anybody
to
keep
them
safe, to Mr. Collins. Whereas Helen's aunt and uncle really dislike Huntingdon, but because Helen wants it so badly, they give in. It's odd in that they're both better guardians and lesser guardians because of it.
They let her make her own mistakes more as well. I mean, her aunt says,
"Look,
how can you
be so much?" And then they allow her to make the huge mistake.
The thing is, though, she loves him, and she seems like the sort of woman who will just do stuff. And it's also written about a period 50 years, 60 years later than the Austens, so maybe the social values have changed, have shifted. I mean, I don't really know, I'm not a massive expert, but maybe it's shifted slightly. She's allowed a little bit more freedom than the Bennets are, I'd say.
Well, Jane Austen always said that she wrote middle-class books for a middle-class audience, and whereas the Brontes, there's always been more of a gothic, more of a realistic tone.
The situation that the Brontes were at, if you don't know anything about it, I'll just briefly run through it. They came from a place called Haworth, which is quite near Keighley, where I work, and it's this countryside around there is stunningly beautiful. The moors are bleak. If you've ever been over the tops, I mean, a really good drive, I'd say, get yourself to Howth and drive back to Leeds, go over the tops of the moors. It's stunning, but you look around and there's nothing, nothing for miles apart from these beautiful houses. And those people lived there, and it would be a very interesting community. You'd know a lot, like Falling for a Dancer, yeah. This kind of community there.
You get up in the middle of the night and sneeze, and the next morning 10 people ask you how your cold is.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the bleakness of the land, and it's very cold and it's very hard. The land isn't great. There's a lot of sheep. There's some farming, but it's not fantastic land. And I think that transcribes to the writing the same way the very English small villageness of Jane Austen, who grew up in a small English country village down south where it was quite nice.
The
north-south divide is very apparent in these books.
But it is that proof positive, isn't it, that you write about what you know.
Exactly.
I was just thinking, when you were talking about Helen, when you were describing her, we're jumping backwards and forth here, but please indulge for a moment.
Yeah.
You know the Forsyth saga?
Yes.
Irene?
Yes.
Don't you think that Helen is a more well-rounded version of Irene?
Yes.
In terms of the circumstance, not the personality?
No, I'd say that no, because Irene is...
She went into it with her eyes open.
Went into it. She knew that Soames was
that she would never love him
for her. Yeah. And I think that Helen was in love with Mr. Huntington, with Arthur, and anyway, so back to the story. So she marries him, he treats her appallingly, he goes down to London and spends 6 months, you know, of the year down there, and doesn't tell her he's ever coming back, and she's stuck in this house.
And to a modern audience, as you're reading the book, we know that he's downstairs shagging his best mate's
wife. Of course
he
is.
But Helen is oblivious. She just thinks he's off being Jack the Lad.
She catches him, like, you know, making eyes at her friend over the piano, and she has a go at him, and he says, "Oh, it was the only time. Oh, I promise I won't do it again." And she forgives him, and it's like, what?
But she's also married to him. She's totally stuck with him.
Yeah, she is completely.
She has any choice.
And then she has a child who she completely loves. I mean, the little boy Arthur. He comes across really nicely. And you know what? The Brontes do children well.
They do. But they were all schoolmarms.
Well, they were.
So they know children quite well.
Governesses. But yeah, they would do. And Arthur Graham, the little lad, comes over as such a sweetheart. He's really, really cute. And in the first half of the book, that's how Gilbert gets to know Helen, because this little boy comes up and plays with his dog, and has a relationship with the little lad, which is really sweet.
Because you're reading... I mean, I first read it as a teenager, and it was the first time I properly got that, you know, some of my friends had separated or whatever, and the phrase that was used at their parents, rather, well, my friends were too young at the time I was a teenager to separate from anybody, but anyway, their parents would, and the phrase du jour was always that that you have to find a male role model for the children, and it really is a 90s phrase, if you know what I mean. It did get overused then,
but reading that phrase, but
I was reading it kind of going, well, I said male role model rather than father figure, I really find the father figure thing
is offensive. You don't need a
if you were raised with your dad being your father figure, it's kind of like, oh, you mean your dad, and if you weren't, then people are sitting there going, I really didn't, or I'd have said it. It's a tricky one, but male role model, and I did, and it wasn't. Nowadays, I suppose they'd have been out playing football or something like that, but it wasn't. The fact that it was sort of the simple act of playing with the dog, because he was a man and he had a dog, you know, and it was a boy's
you
dog,
you
know,
it
was lovely.
Now. And, you know, and Gilbert, I think, he's early 20s in the book, and he's obviously
he's young,
time,
but he's a very decent character.
But he comes across as quite a decent man. But anyway, back to the story.
Oh, God, and his relationship with his sister is actually really well realised.
No, his sister's really sweet. But anyway, so she has this little kid, and then Arthur just goes and...
She hands Gilbert her diary and does a disappearing act. Yeah. What Gilbert doesn't know is that some of her family have heard from her husband, and he's ill to the point where they think he might be dying.
He's literally drunk himself
into a stupor and can't wake up.
And she has escaped from this with her son to live with her brother, who turns out to be the guy that everybody in the village thinks that she's having an affair with, even though she's not. Because basically Gilbert sees, you know, Mr. Lawrence giving her a hug and goes, oh no, I hate you forever.
She can maintain
and then
the
it
physical
turns
contact
out to
with
be
man.
Her brother. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things that I think now
it's
seen
been
so
overused.
Many, we've
but
seen
then,
it so much. But, it, you know, it's quite a nice little device for, you know, 150 years ago. And
of course, if she'd ever said to anybody, my brother owns the house I'm living in, everybody would have immediately gone, Mr. Lawrence is your brother, and it would have totally...
It would have been fine.
Yeah.
No,
it's her Arthur made her so secretive that it impacted on her life. If she had been a little bit more Helen when she first moved to Tennant Hall, it wouldn't have been half as dramatic a story.
But the thing is, the basic moral of the story is the way that drunkenness affects the whole family. And I think with Anne Bronte, with her brother, you know, who she was, you know, living with for quite many years, and more so than the other two sisters who were out and about, I think, that will have affected her massively. And she died when she was very young. I mean, they all died quite young. But, you know, it would have affected her. And I think that this is a very cathartic novel, in that it's kind of, you can see the pain that Helen goes through is real. And I think that if Anne hadn't had that experience, horrible as it was, then she wouldn't have written this book. And I think that...
And the landscape is a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those books where it's not overdone, but there's this pervasive... If you've ever read Angela's Ashes, you know how you read Angela's Ashes and then you go, what's Limerick like? It rains a lot. This is like that. It's you're reading this going, the Tenant of Wildfell Hall, what happens? Well, anytime anybody feels bad, there's a storm. It's convenient.
It's not
but
as
it's
well
so
done as
well
Wuthering
done.
Heights, but Wuthering Heights is about the
I'm
place,
sorry,
so.
I do not know the book of which you mean.
we should point out now. Right.
Are you, of course, referring to Wuthering Shites?
Oh, I am, yes, that's right,
because
sorry.
Because if you are referring to Wuthering Shites, I'm just going to say, we are not discussing that, but I do think you should go and find a blog called...
And Burn Your Bones. If you go on Twitter and just look up at Burn Your Bones...
And then follow... The link to her blog. She has read Wuthering Shites, so you don't have to. And that is as much as we are saying. In fact, if we could, I know that there were six Bronte's children, but two of them died before they ever made any reference. One is clearly the inspiration behind this story, if not the author of it. And then if we could just pretend that Emily never existed at all.
Oh, but Emily, her parents were lovely. We'll do an Emily. We'll put an Emily Bronte poem on the blog.
There we go. We'll compensate.
Sorry, Emily.
Yeah. Wuthering Shites is absolutely appalling.
Anyway, so Tenant of the Wildfell Hall. I think that's more or less. If you never read it, read it. It's very
well. We might as well. We've given so much detail about certain parts of it. We might as well finish. Mm. Basically, she goes back and nurses her husband. One of the things that, as
she
a child,
to her
I didn't like about the book, but it's something that has grown on me on rereads. I actually think it's quite beautifully articulated. Oh. Is that Helen is a good Christian, and it's very important to her that she is a good Christian. And when she goes back and nurses her husband, it is either one of the nicest examples of how good people do good things, even when they know there's no reward for themselves, or it's the most sanctimonious, pious piece of horseshit that ever existed.
No, I think that she does.
She basically, the whole reason we find out, the only reason that she actually left Arthur is, and it's so true, and it's classic, is that he was very abusive to her and she tolerated it. Then one night he got their 11-year-old son rat-arsed drunk, and she looked at what he was doing to her child and thought, you can do what you like to me, but you don't touch the boy. Yeah. And that's why she ran. She goes back to take care of him because he's so terribly ill. And there is no rapprochement, there's no conclusion. He never has that epiphany. He has a couple of those like, pray for me because if I die I'm going to go to hell and I don't want to go to hell, but if you pray for me you're a good person and therefore it'll all balance out moments. But he never actually has any epiphany. He never apologises. And in the end...
I'm sorry I ruined your life. You know, it'd be nice to say, really.
But in the end he's still more angry about the fact that because she ran off, she made it impossible for his mistress to come and stay with him anymore. You know, I mean, there's a lot of elements when you realise what a bore he actually is.
He's just not a good person, really.
But in the end, he succumbs. And then the really interesting thing is that she kind of... She knows what she wants, but she's become so secretive, she doesn't articulate it to anybody. So she sort of sorts her life out in the hopes that she's going to meet Gilbert and everything will go okay. But she never gets in touch with him. She doesn't reach out or anything. So he's quietly going mad back in the village.
Yeah.
And one day she just sort of sends for him. But it's lovely because it's such a reversal of how it's normally done in that era of books. Usually the women are so passive, but in this he actually respects. She says, "Leave me alone," and he respects it. He respects it even to the point where it's driving him. But I mean, his sister is literally doing that thing where she's tearing her hair out, going, "I've thrown every nice girl in the county at you, and you're not even looking. You're not even awake," you know. And then Helen reappears, and explains everything, and it's kind of, it's like the dam bursts and you hope that she'll never build it up again. It's so lovely. But it really, I'm getting all gushy here.
I think the ending just, Gilbert just comes over as, again, a thoroughly decent bloke. I mean, he takes her into the fold, he marries her in, and they have a life together, and it's almost as if, like, he completely forgives everything because he understands that it was horrible. And I think that he it's never like he has any kind of, well, you know, you shouldn't have married in the first place, or, you know, any of that.
He understands.
Just completely just says, and he takes his son on, and I think, you know,
that's a big deal.
That back then it would have been, and
that's a big deal for now.
It's more socially acceptable, but it's still, I think, a consideration. Yeah.
You know, when a couple get together, you've got to get on with the kids, and you know, make
sure that it's essential.
But
you're not just going out with them, are you?
So. Back then, it's not like right, and the kid comes with the mum or anything. Gilbert really, he really loves the little boy in his own right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I enjoy most, and we're going to start moving into Jane Eyre a little bit now. Just time wise, we need to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to recap the story of Jane Eyre. If you don't know the story of Jane Eyre, then you have a moral obligation to the world to go out and read it.
Or at least watch
fantastic.
The series.
Or at least, yeah.
But don't watch the weird old film
that we watched the other day,
because it was wrong.
Really strange.
And we just caught it. It was on, like, film four.
It's like 1939 version of, I might be exaggerating there. It was 40s
Orson
or something.
Wells or something?
Yeah, it was, well, I don't know.
Was it Orson Welles?
It was some actor that we know from the era, but we were watching him going, wow, he really grew in his craft, because this is crap.
It's very much like
and Jane
gothic
is
lighting.
Like this gorgeous blossoming flower. And throughout the entire thing, we both kept going, isn't Jane meant to be a bit plain?
In the, was it the BBC version?
The BBC is a 2003 with Toby Stevens.
Yes.
The BBC one with, it's not Toby Stevens. No, it is, because he then plays Rochester, doesn't he, about 10 years later. Wait, are we talking about Tennant or Jane Eyre?
Jane Eyre.
Oh, then, yeah, it's Toby Stevens.
Yeah. It's the one, and the woman who was recently in that programme that had... We're doing this very badly now.
We really are.
Anyway, move on. Basically, there's a recent adaptation that's very good.
Yeah.
Watch that, it's very good.
It's
and,
the BBC
and the
one, the most
recent
one. The
woman who plays Jane in that one
is fantastic.
Really well done. And she gets Jane right on the knuckle, because she's not... gorgeous, and Jane isn't gorgeous. I mean, she is beautiful,
but
in
she's
right,
secure.
But she's pure.
But
she's
the whole reason that I brought up Jane Eyre is that the Brontes do this thing where they don't like Jane Austen. It ends with the wedding. It ends with the kiss. It ends with the happily ever after bit. The Austens don't believe in that. In Jane Eyre, you get your happy ending, and then she tells you what happened to every other character and what their hopes are for the future. And it's like there is no ending. The love story, the romance might have ended, but the love story's just begun. And in Tennant as well, they do that thing where they don't leave you hanging. They kind of fill it in a little. And I like that. I think it's a far more realistic style.
Yeah.
But Jane Eyre is Tennant is probably my favourite of the Bronte books, because I think it's very subtle in some ways and really obvious in others. But I think Jane is the better book.
Oh, Jane's an amazingly good book.
Just length.
I studied Jane. I mean, I did creative
do
writing.
Do not read Under the Sargasso Sea, which is the prequel.
You see,
to
I
it.
Quite enjoyed the wide. Is it the Wide Sargasso Sea?
Under the Wide Sargasso Sea.
I quite enjoyed that. I only read that this year, but
I made the mistake of watching it before I read
Jane Eyre the book. The structuring of it and the way that the mystery unfolds and the way that this character is built up, it's very Dickensian in that it starts off when she's a child.
It's in thirds as well.
And it goes into, yeah, exactly. And
child and school.
Woman, and then...
Child, school, growing up.
Yeah.
Then
young
moving
woman.
To Rochester's house in...
Yeah.
What's it called?
Oh, God. We can't remember.
Oh, my
house.
God.
Find the house. Right, basically, the first third is her in school. The second third is her as a young woman,
as
learning
as
to be herself, and the third is her a bit more mature, a bit wiser. She's had her test, as it were, and
Thornfield,
yes. And I think that the structure of it's like a complete story about this character, which is why I think it is Jane Eyre is the name of the book. It's her story.
It's her life,
and I think that the way that Charlotte Bronte has made this book into such a succinct and complete story. It doesn't need any add-ons. It doesn't need any prequels or sequels or anything like that. I think it's very brave of the woman who wrote Wild Sargasso Sea to explore the Bertha side of the story, because the way that Bertha is represented, the mad woman in the attic, she doesn't get really much of it.
She's not a person. She's the crazy woman in the attic. She's not a person in her own right.
And I think it's very interesting. The book, The Rise of Gatsby, I thought fell down in places because it was quite difficult to read. But I think it is worth giving it a shot, and it's an interesting thing. I think it's a lot better than the shit Austin sequels
God,
and prequels.
The Life of Miss Mary Bennet.
I've not read
Shoot
the zombie
me,
one, so I'm not going to mention the zombie one because I've not read it. It might be brilliant. It's a very, very
the
good
zombie
idea.
One is awesome.
It's a very, very good idea.
It's not Pride and Prejudice as we know it, but it actually manages to be. Do you know the other thing that does it really well? Jasper Ford in The Air Affair.
I've not read that.
Jasper Ford writes these books, but they're set in an alternative universe where if you change the original copy of the book, all of the copies in the world then subsequently Ooh. Change. So somebody steals, it's Miss Havisham is the lead investigator from Great Expectations. And they go through, and in their verse, somebody changes the ending of Jane Eyre, and you realise that they've changed it to our ending. That version of the world, Jane and Rochester never got together because there is no magic. She doesn't hear his voice when he cries out to her, you know, in that really powerful. And it always reminded me of The Secret Garden and The Little Princess.
Yeah.
You know that how they brought in. It was like
the
back
spirits.
Then it was still okay. You could be a Christian,
and
but it was still okay to believe in
gardens,
magic.
Where is Secret Garden set?
I chose Yorkshire to live in for a reason.
Exactly. You know, this is
I
the
want
thing.
To find a Dickon of my own.
Sweetie, come to Keighley. But no, in Yorkshire there is this sense of you live the land and the land teaches you how to live. And if you've ever been up on, especially the North York Moors and Bempton Cliffs, I'd recommend just stand there and don't put your iPod in and just listen to the wind, and you can feel it.
When you think about it, it's quite significant. In two of her books, Jane Austen sends the primary protagonist up north. You know, in one the Lake District, but they also
Derbyshire.
Go further.
Derbyshire.
But they go further, don't they?
They were going
to
go
the
to
rocks.
The lakes, but they didn't.
Yeah, but it's always implied. I like the fact that Yorkshire is so much a part of England. It's got such a unique
it's
cadence and history
England's
and mythology.
God's
and
own county.
God's own county.
God's own
yeah.
county, man. It's like on the census. What's your national identity? Tyke. You know, everybody should put this just to confuse. But no, I mean, Jane Eyre is a beautiful book. I think it's probably my favourite Bronte. I love The Tenant of Rotherhall because I think, you know, the whole woman empowerment thing is very strong, and the breaking away
it's
from
quite
his abusive husband.
Feminist
it is a feminist fairy tale in a way. But well, it would have been better if she stood her own 2 feet and not go back to Gilbert. But he's a nice guy, so we'll let her.
No, but what I kind of liked in it is Gilbert worked for her.
Yeah.
She didn't have to seek him out.
With Jane Eyre, it's a horror story. It's a really scary story. I mean, Jane Eyre is sat. She doesn't know anything about the house. She's already had a weird ass childhood, growing up in Lowood Hall in this school, which is horrible.
After her aunt, basically, her aunt promised to care for her like one of her own children. After her uncle died, lied and chucked her into this orphanage that specialises in killing off its children.
Yeah. Oh, horrible.
Really nasty.
Horrible.
And the only false note, and it works so well the first time you read it, but on every subsequent read, you just think, oh, when is Helen Byrne going to die already? She has this Mary Sue type friend. She is like the perfect
Sue.
Little girl.
Oh.
She has
angel wings.
She's like Beth in Little Woman without any of the nuance that makes Little Beth the character in Little Woman and not just the one that dies so they all get to have a good sob in the middle of the story, you know. But I really disliked that aspect of it. Mm. What I really love about the version that they put on the BBC is that when you read the book, as I say, there are lots of little touches of magic and sex, really, that you don't appreciate until you're a bit older reading them. The BBC visualised this through very... when I say graphic, I don't mean sexually graphic, but I mean like quite graphic dreams, as in with very dramatic colour sequences and specific music, and the nuance is all about this connection. Jane isn't like Helen. Jane doesn't find a nice guy and think, yeah, I could build a life with him. Jane and Rochester are drawn together. Their chemistry and everything, and that comes across so beautifully. I think it's 2004. In the BBC version that they do. I quite like the one with... Is it
Samantha Morton?
Yeah, I quite like that one as well.
I like
which
that
is
one
the one
lot.
That has Anna Paquin as the child, the Charlotte Gainsbury one?
I believe that was the Morton one, the Samantha Morton one, I believe. The thing I like about Thornfield is Mrs. Fairfax and all the other servants and Adele. Is it Adele or Adela? The little
Adele.
Girl. She's so. I mean, she's, you know, if she was one of my kids, I'd have, you know, sold to her. You know, you don't get anything. I want, don't get. It doesn't work like that. She's spoiled. She's a coquette. But she has this little tiny air about her. And you can tell that actually she's quite a sweet little kid. And she falls in love with Jane. And Jane's
the only problem that anybody has with Adele, because she's not the sharpest tool in the box, but you know. No, but it's like some people are academic and some people are practically minded. She's got great visual sense, not so much into the book learning. But the only contrast that Adele has with any other character is that she's naturally both cheerful and optimistic, which is something that Rochester had but has lost, and Jane had beaten out of her before she was old enough to be able to articulate it. And in some cases, I actually literally mean beaten out of her. I mean, it was she had a very violent. She had the Oliver Twist upbringing, minus the singing thieves. Because, you know, Cockney pickpockets are really cheerful in real life.
The singing thieves weren't in the book. Jane, I think, as a character, grows because she's always trying to discover who she is. I think when you have a childhood that involves abuse and also neglect and, you know, living in a horrible, horrible place and just having your friends die on you and being, you know, constantly told that you're a sinner and you're a liar, it doesn't really give you much chance, I would say, to discover who she is. And I think that Rochester lets her do that.
What I also like is, no, she makes the time for herself. Even back at Lowood, she would go and paint Helen Burns's graveyard. She insisted on taking a half an hour or whatever of her day to be herself. And
really
her way
her.
Of doing that was to draw. I understand her motivations throughout. I really like that. I don't know if I would act the same way as she acts, but I totally understand why she responds in that way. She's a very logical character. It all makes a great deal of sense.
But if you read the book now, it is so scary. The idea of something being there that you don't know what it is, and you have all these ideas, but you can't talk to anybody about them because you think they're going mad. And madness, I think, is explored a lot in that. Obviously, Bertha, the woman in the attic, is mentally ill.
But Rochester is also not well.
Rochester is not well, and again, Jane suffers from depression at times. And I think that the idea that everyone kind of keeps it to themselves, and because madness wasn't talked about and it wasn't done properly medically, Bertha probably would have been okay if she hadn't been locked in an attic to a certain extent.
The character really brings to mind the original wife in South Riding.
Very much so. She had problems, but
The difference is that the young'un in South Riding, she knew what would happen if she got pregnant and had a kid. She knew she had this weakness in the line, as it were. Whereas Bertha was sold.
We haven't read the book of South Riding. We're only taking it from the TV series.
I should have said I'm planning on reading the book. I'll let you know whether it's different or not.
Yeah, we'll let you know it's different.
But it's certainly in the TV series. That's the character that. Whereas Bertha, I don't know if Bertha ever had any concept of how ill she actually was. It really feels like she was sold as a bill of goods by her father and brother.
Oh, the women as objects thing. I mean, Jane really is. She is passed from authority character to authority character, really, in the way. But she always, you know, when she breaks free from Lowood, in the same way, she is trying to make her own living in the world, but then she is completely dependent on that living.
One
she has no
own.
Kind of stable home background that she can go to, and I think that it's a bit of a feminist novel in that she kind of makes her own destiny.
But
in a
to
way.
Contrast with Helen, Jane breaks away, leaves Thornfield, and leaves Mr. Rochester because it's the right thing to do, and she manages to rebuild herself. She manages to rebuild herself as a school teacher, thanks in large part to cousins she didn't know she had. Another one of those beautiful sort of, and again. Because now it's such a familiar thing to do, it lessens the impact. But that was the first book I read that did that, where the convenient cousins appeared next door.
But that would happen
in Yorkshire,
because we're all related.
And it would happen in Yorkshire. It's not impossible. It would happen in Ireland too. But she remakes herself thanks to the support of her family. And she doesn't go and find Rochester.
No.
She doesn't go and find Rochester until St. John proposes. Now, I have to say, I love St. John.
I like St. John. He's a good man. He's going to take her off into Africa and
I would find it very difficult to interact with somebody like him.
I don't think we'd get on.
But I admire so much his focus.
No. I like his family as well. I think they're all very sweet. And they all look out for her. And they all just fall in love with her. And it works very well. And I think that's
But they would have looked out for her, even if she wasn't, even if they didn't like her. Because that's what you do. You take care of people.
Do you think maybe that family could be compared to the Brontes? Because they are the sisters and the brother. And if the brother hadn't been an alcoholic dickhead. Not that all alcoholics dickheads, but, you know,
I think it is a parallel setup. The difference being that the two girls, I think the difference being between the Branston, that was the brother in real life.
Mm.
He Branwell. Apparently, Branwell, beg your pardon, Branwell Branston, like the pickle.
Like the pickle. He's in a pickle.
That pickle brother that they had, the pickled brother, which might be more to the point. Sorry, that was a little bit harsh.
Oh God!
The lush that they lived with,
yeah,
apparently had a literary talent easily as good as his sisters. That was part of the problem. He was as talented as them, or certainly a talented literary person
who
never made
it
work.
Have ever read Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons?
You're obsessed with this book.
It's brilliant. That's why there's a bit in the book where
it is lovely.
Flora Post is meeting this writer.
This is what I'm going to do.
And the writer is like, I'm writing a novel about Branwell Bronte and how the sisters stole his talent and la la la. And apparently back in like the 30s and 40s it was a big thing, especially for men to be like kind of reclaim Branwell as a hero. And I think that at the end of the day, have you ever read the Bronte sisters books? They're incredible. I don't give a shit what Branwell was doing. I've already got amazing good books out of this family and I'm not going to go hunting for more. Quite frankly, the Bronte sisters are fantastic.
I can't believe I'm doing this twice now. Little Women again.
Mm.
Jo becomes a writer and a teacher, but she writes as well. And as kids, they all got together in the attic and they'd all act out these plays, and it was a very communal thing. But I could also see how in that setup you could have had one of them feel like Jo was hogging all of the stories and resenting them for that. But the original point that I was going to make about Branwell being talented and it being unrealised is that I think St. John is the and he is an archetype and he is a stereotype as well.
He's like a perfect
but he is the brother that had the focus and in fact they go too far in the other direction. He's the brother that not only had the focus that Branwell lacked, but was so determined to act on it he became almost blinkered to the world around him.
Mm.
The only character I do feel very sorry for the little girl that's in love with him.
Mm.
And she is a little girl. She's a little poppet.
I can't remember that.
I hate Lady Ingram. Blanche Ingram. I really dislike her mother. And I like the twins that are socialising with them.
I do enjoy the bit with the gyps with the fortune teller and how he's paid her off.
But again,
like
when you reread that, do you not
really
reread
creepy.
That and think it's like the most? It's the least likely thing that would ever happen ever in the world of anything ever.
Oh, I think that's quite a, I mean, it's obviously Mr. Rochester a bit of a devious cat.
Again, I prefer the slight step away that the BBC took in that he paid a gypsy woman to come in and say what he had told her, whereas in the book Mr. Rochester, this incredibly distinctive looking man, dresses up as a woman and nobody recognises him. Because, you know, nobody wears costumes back then. Masquerade balls weren't the do of the day and nobody had learned to recognise a man by anything other than his physical features. I never bought into it. I like the fact that in the book he paid someone to do it, but it's magic in the book, because you've no idea reading it.
Mm.
Jane is when Jane starts to figure it out. You're maybe a step ahead of her, and I like that because as a kid
it
made me feel smart.
Dramatic irony.
It's well realised dramatic irony. I'm now being all bossy britches bitches because that's what I am. Move on to your Austin.
I think.
We're pausing. We've only got 10 minutes to do.
We've only got 10 minutes left.
We kind of rambled.
Okay, Austins. Basically,
you do Persuasion, I'll do P&P.
Okay, we'll do Pride and Prejudice first, though, because
okay,
it came first. It was published first.
Pride and Prejudice. Yummy. The book is one of those things that every 13-year-old should have given to them.
I kind of want to meet a 13-year-old just so I can be the first person to introduce to Pride and Prejudice.
Well, we've found ourselves our very own 30-year-old, and she's never read it, and she's now reading it and watching it with us. So you could say that, you know, we've started on the wrong end of the scale, but we're working our way down, and soon we will find teenagers to equally lead astray.
If I can introduce one of my kids to Pride and Prejudice, I'll be a happy woman.
Do you know what? If anybody else, if some bloody teacher or librarian hands them a copy of the book before I get to, I'm going to be pissed.
Pride and Prejudice. I watched the BBC very, very famous series with Colin Firth.
I read it before I watched it.
Read it before she watched it. So for me, I was 11 when I watched the TV series. It was on Sunday night TV. So it was one of those things you watch with your mum on a Sunday night, and on Monday you all met in the playground and went, oh my God, did you see him with the shirt and everything?
I had a very different experience. I would go down, I started reading it because we'd heard this adaptation would happen, and I didn't take very long to read it, but Mum was dying for me to finish it so she could get the TV series. We went down to the video store and we would rent the videos, and the videos were recordings of the BBC version. So we got to see it with all the adverts and stuff, but about a year and a half after it had aired.
Where were you when that was Zim? Yeah.
But it was fantastic, and every week you'd go down and, like, somebody that had found it the week after you, you'd literally be swapping videos in the video store, and they're all copies. It was great.
But it's such, I mean, it's
best
such a good
add-on
series.
Of any Jane Austen adaptation ever has to be the wet t-shirt scene.
Yes, definitely.
It's the
wet
great.
T-shirt scene. But anyway, it's a really great series. The book.
Every character in the BBC version fits the character in the book perfectly, except perhaps the mother.
No, I disagree.
Who is a caricature, really, but a beautifully well done
one. I really like the mum in that. I did like Brenda Bethan more, but I think that she's really, really good.
She's shrill, though. She's very shrill.
Anyway, the book
is brilliant. Mrs. Phelps is so wickedly good.
The book is brilliant. We're not going to tell the plot. Basically, five sisters, they all get married. It's a treaty, not necessarily marriage. The
single man in possession of good fortune must be wonderful life.
And that's basically the plot.
You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you.
The plot is the first sentence in this book.
Yeah.
The Bennet sisters, Elizabeth Bennet, everybody wants to be her. Jane, but lovely.
Actually, Jane is the false note in the BBC version.
No, I disagree, because I really like Jane.
Again,
in the BBC
after
version.
Seeing, is her name Gwendolyn?
Rosamund
Pike.
Pike. Oh, she's
after
stunning.
Seeing her as Jane, it was just kind of like, yeah, that I like.
Sorry, I like the BBC Jane. I think she's got pre-Raphaelite, that classic look. I like her.
I knew her from House of Cards, and she's excellent in that.
Jane,
as well.
And then you've got Kitty and Lydia,
the younger sisters.
And Mary, who is the blue stocking.
Decapitated our camera.
Oh, no. Is it working?
It's still on.
Okay, sorry, we dropped the mic.
We're such pros, do you know what I mean? Reached for coffee.
The Bennet sisters.
Yeah.
And Mr. Darcy.
The primary thing about this book isn't actually the women. The women are fantastic characters, but they're the protagonists. The best thing about this book are the secondary characters, who are the men. Mr. Collins, Mr. Wickham, Mr. Darcy, and to a certain extent, Mr. Bingley. And how much did you love him until the moment that he turned? And every single person I know that read the book, even if they'd read it knowing that he turns out to be a little bit of a knob end, they still end up at some point or another thinking, oh, he's the hero, you know. And it's just fantabulously, wonderfully marvellous.
I think the way she creates an entire community, and you all, but you could, I mean, we
could, I could answer questions about Netherfield. I could tell you where the rooms are.
I could walk down that street and know what I was doing, and I'd know how to behave. The social manners are explored so well in Pride.
One of my favourite scenes is the card games up in her aunt's.
Yes.
When they go to Meryton and they play a card game. It's basically where Wickham tells what I always call the pity me story.
Oh.
He gives Elizabeth his pity me story in a public place, surrounded by other people, because, you know, it's not like any of them will gossip.
I think that Elizabeth, my favourite scene is the bits with Lady Catherine de Bourgh. I love
Lady Catherine. And that introduces what I call the Pride and Prejudice mystery, which is who betrayed Elizabeth Bennet? Because the second appearance of Lady Catherine de Bourgh is when she basically arrives at the house in the first thing in the morning, demands to speak with Elizabeth in order to announce that she must cancel her engagement to Darcy.
Yes.
An engagement that doesn't currently exist. And who told her? I think it has to be Charlotte Collins. I think that Charlotte said something to Mr. Collins along the lines of something going on there with my best mate and that sulky rich dude.
I think Colonel Fitzwilliam.
And Mariah would have been able to write
something. I think that Darcy's poured his heart out to his mate, and his mate...
His cousin.
And his cousin has turned around and told his aunt to warn her.
I don't know, because I just don't think that... I just don't think that he'd have done that.
We don't know him that well, though.
He's totally honest with Elizabeth. He makes clear that he likes her an awful lot, but he, as the second son of an earl, needs to find a wealthier woman. But he is thoroughly good-humoured. And when he brings up Jane and the Bennets, he's the one that goes... You know, the more I think about it, the more I think that was a little bit high-handed of him. He did it for the best intentions. And that is the first time I think that Elizabeth ever gets any sense that Darcy has good intentions. Mm. That he's not just the prig. But it could be, or it could have been Mariah writing to Charlotte.
Yeah, it could have been Mariah writing to Charlotte. We just don't know.
We just don't know.
Anyway, Pride and Prejudice, brilliant, read it. Yeah. Fantastic book. Persuasion is my favourite Bronte
before
novel.
Before you get started wearing my bossy britches bitches yes. shirts, I'm now saying you have 5 minutes and no more.
Right.
And this is a you hear her, you'll understand why.
Persuasion is probably one of my favourite books.
Because you're Anne Elliot.
Because I'm Anne Elliot. Oh God, I am. And you know what? In a year's time, I'm going to be the same age Anne Elliot is when he comes back. And it's going to happen, damn it. Basically, Persuasion. If you haven't read it, and not many people have, I'm not being like, you know, a massive cow in the sky or anything, but it's the book that, it's like Sense and Sensibility, it's the one that people
It's a little bit hard to get into. It's possibly the toughest of her books to get into.
It's the last of her books that she wrote it. Well, it's not the last of her books. She died when she was
writing Lady Susan and the Watson.
She was still writing when she died, but it's, you know, one of the later books, and she is no longer a young woman writing about people in the village that she knows and love and romance. She's an older woman who's been there, and Anne Elliot, I think, is just...
Anne Elliot is proposed to by the love of her life, and she turns him down because he doesn't have many prospects.
Because she's persuaded by her dad's friend to look for better things.
Instantly regrets it, and he buggers off to sea, and then has this amazing career, and conveniently enough comes back in a year's time for Jess.
In 10 years time.
Yeah, no, but a year's time in terms of your age.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
he comes back next year. And He comes back next year, and he's really successful and wonderful. And she basically did the thing that none of Jane Austen's heroines are ever supposed to do. After he left, she sat down and reevaluated her life and said, I have made a mistake. I am not going to marry the wrong person to make up for this mistake. And although she recognises herself that she's more in love with the memory of him than him himself, she's faithful. She just sort of gets on and does nothing for 10 years and ends up this spinster woman.
She's 27 in the book and...
Totally past it.
Well, obviously.
I mean, can you imagine being 27 and single? I mean, there's no reason to live, is there?
kill yourself now. But anyway, her family and everyone around her, I think, they're so funny. Her dad is this self-obsessed snob of a man who is just...
Do you think that Jane had real issues with her father? Because all the father figures in her books are a bit weak.
Mr. Bennet's great!
Mr. Bennet is weak, and he admits it himself.
Yes, but he admits it himself, so therefore he's not...
No, recognition of weakness is not an attempt to rectify the situation.
I don't know, I think it's the first step.
He ends up joking to
Kitty.
Anyway,
we're talking about Persuasion. We're talking about my favourite book, shut up.
Another weak father figure.
And then there's this other family, the Musgroves, and they're really well realised, and they're really funny as well. And there's always this little bit of, ooh, well, you
Will
could
she,
have married
she?
Him. And then, you
the
know,
captain
the
is perfect,
come back,
by the way.
Captain,
the admiral.
Captain Wentworth comes back, yeah. And...
Hubba.
And it's this tension, and I think that she gets the tension. Just, you know, when you're in a room with somebody and there's chemistry. I mean, I've definitely been in this situation. They're there. And you can't do anything about it.
It's a bad idea, but sparks are flying.
You don't know how they feel, but you know how you feel, and it's killing you. That sort of tension she gets, and I think that she's been there, man. Jane must have been in that situation to write that so beautifully. And the bit where she thinks that she fancies these young sisters, who the Musgrove sisters, who are lovely, lovely girls.
Jess, you said that, and you made me think of becoming Jane.
I'm sorry.
Shot in my hometown, actually. Go watch the movie and go, ooh, isn't...
Ireland lovely.
Isn't Ireland beautiful? But ignore the storyline that says you can't be single and happy.
And ignore the American casting of Jane Austen.
Mumble, grumble. Right, back to the story.
Captain Wentworth, the bit where... I mean, just read the book, but basically, you know, it's Nostin, they're going to get together at the end. And how that
But they get together, and the way it comes about, it's actually far better. Yeah, oh God, Jane does good letters. Jane Austen writes good letters. I'm sorry I'm calling her Jane throughout, but it's an affectation we've both developed.
She doesn't mind, it's Jane. Our friend Jane. Jane Austen is my homegirl, I really want the t-shirt.
Funnily enough, there is something that she wrote in one of her letters to her sisters, and she's wrong. She thinks Elizabeth Bennet's favourite colour is yellow.
No,
it's not yellow.
Red.
Yeah.
It's red. This is what Austen does to you. It makes you realise the character's favourite colours. And I think...
And everything in Persuasion is tinged with blue.
There is a, you know, a bit... Well, it's the sea, isn't it? There is a bit of a, you know, a thing for women of our age to have a bit of a crush on Jane Austen because of the series when we had when we were growing up and because it's Jane Austen. But I think there's nothing wrong with that, you know. People take the mick out of it a lot.
The most important thing to remember about Jane Austen is that at the time that she wrote her books, underwear wasn't invented, so basically she was going commando. Sorry.
You can feel the breeze. You can definitely feel the breeze.
I read that in one of those... Do you know that book you lent me that was like the...
Oh, Be Your Own Jane Austen.
Be Your Own Jane Austen. And it basically breaks down all of the men, all the characters, all the clothes they wear.
If you've ever seen Choose Your Own Adventure novels that are brilliant, you should definitely have a look at this. One called Be Your Own Jane Austen. And it's basically a Choose Your Own Adventure, but with all the Austen books combined. So you go through every single Austen book.
But all the characters have their own little sort of paragraphs at the end. It's really funny. But that just leapt out at the page at me. I thought it was hilarious.
And the thing is, though, because I know so much about Jane Austen... I won that book. I won that the first time I did it. I got to the end.
I think
Mr. Darcy, I win.
I think the I think one of the reasons. I believe that one of the characters that Sebastian Fox has covered on his TV show when he talks about why we love fictional characters are the Austen women. I find it so interesting that very recently, as I say, we've introduced this friend of ours to P&P, and we went round, and there are five of us, four of whom know the TV series so well, we're like going, do the music bit.
What do I do? That's the Antiques Roadshow theme.
Oh my God, I've completely lost it.
Oh my God. Oh God.
We end up pianoing along during the interludes. That's how well we know. You've thrown it from me now, but we know it that well. We know everything about it. We can have conversations about Jane Austen's world. It has become part of our psyche. I love that. I think it is the sign of an Dickens does it as well, actually. We all have a little bit of Dickens in us, if it is just the Muppets Christmas Carol. Here comes Mr. Humble.
I'm down in Hertfordshire with Jane, I think. But yeah, if you've never read Persuasion, please do, because it's beautiful. And if you are, you know, in your late 20s like me.
So the scoring system today is going to be incredibly simple. Bronte sisters, A++. Jane Austen. A++.
You can't compare the two. I couldn't live in a world that didn't have either of them in them.
You get so many different things from each of them.
I think if I had to never read a book again, one of them again, I think I'd choose Jane over the Brontes, because I read Persuasion at least once a year. Because
had to pick one of them, I think I'd almost rather neither existed, because they complement each other so well. They're similar time frames. Certainly, the further back in time you go, the more closely aligned different eras become. But I gained so much from both of them. Different things, like from the Brontes, I did get that slightly gothic, you know, dreamy imagination. And then from Austen, it's more the, you know, social responsibilities and communities. And I can't separate the two. If I can't have both, I can't have either. It's unbalanced. The world is an unbalanced place without both of these sets of books existing.
And also, you know, I am going to say it, Jane Austen wrote under the title of The Lady, because if she was a woman known to be a writer in the early 1800s, then she'd have been socially ostracised. Brontes had to pretend to be men in order to get published. I think the fact that now women like us and strong independent women can still read these books and still get something from it, I think that they're champion, and I think that they should need to be celebrated. And I think that I wouldn't be the person I am today without either of these writers. I don't think you'd be the person you are today without either of these writers. And I think that if you have not explored these writers, then you need to to learn who you are as a person.
If you happen to be a parent, with a daughter.
Oh God, buy a Jane Austen copy.
It is something we both share, and our silent partner is the same. This is a book we acquired via our mums.
Yeah.
and it is something that, I don't know, I might lose every memory in my head, but the relationship that I have with Mum, it's cemented on little things like this,
yeah.
Little moments where she gave me Anne Frank's diary and she introduced me to Jane Austen. It's just a magical thing to do with your daughter.
If you've got one book that you can buy your daughter, buy her Pride and Prejudice, I think. And sit there and read it as well yourself and talk about
the book. We read the first chapter together.
I would definitely. I wouldn't read it to your children, but I'd let them read it on their own. But
I'd let them read the first chapter to you, just because the language is so beautiful. You'll never
read it alongside them, and you know, it's such a beautiful book. And I think if you know you're a woman who's read maybe a couple of Jane Austen's, and if you're a man, even, I mean, geez, why am I just talking about women?
And if you're struggling with the idea, if you're not somebody who naturally sort of reads the classics, then what I would say to you is that if you enjoyed Bridget Jones's Diary, you will love. Because there are so many, Clueless, if you liked Clueless, that's based on Emma. If you liked, you know, so many things in the modern world that are based on these.
Yeah,
you know.
If you like your scary Jane Patterson style stories, read Jane Eyre, because it's a very good horror.
Anyway. Oh my god, we deserve a freaking medal. We're under the hour.
Hooray!
Huzzah! Go for the elf and the other one.
Right, well, thank you very much for listening to us rant on.
If anybody has any suggestions on things that you would like to hear us ramble on, please get in touch on Twitter to Book Elf Leeds or Leeds Book Club. And thank you again for listening.
Thank you. You can also find more of our rantings on the website,
which is
leedsbookclub.blogspot.com.
Yes. And yeah,
ciao for now.
Suck on the wind downs. Bye.